This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the Post's newsroom to life on stage.
Jonathan Majors is one of Hollywood's fastest rising stars, with roles in Lovecraft Country, The Last Black Man in San Francisco, and The Five Bloods. In this episode, he joins Washington Post Live to discuss how his performances have portrayed Black masculinity, the role of culture and reckoning in race and history, and his latest projects. Let's listen.
Good afternoon. I'm Jonathan Capehart, opinion writer for The Washington Post. Welcome to Washington Post Live and another in our series on race in America. As my colleague Helena Andrews Dyer pointed out in the Post, our guest today is an actor who's, and this is a quote, quickly becoming that guy you can't stop seeing in, well, everything. I first saw him as the quirky Mont in The Last Black Man in San Francisco, and he exploded on the scene as Atticus, the intense action hero lead in the Golden Globe-nominated HBO series Lovecraft Country, where the horrors of Jim Crow are sometimes a lot scarier than the monsters they encounter. He was also in The Five Bloods, Spike Lee's epic film about Black vets going back to Vietnam. Of course, I'm talking about the man that you see next to me on screen, Jonathan Majors. Jonathan, welcome to Washington Post Live.
Oh, peace. Peace, my brother. A fellow Jonathan. What's up?
Right. So you told my colleague Helena about your role in Lovecraft Country. You said this role presented to the world with dignity and honor and sincerity will alter the hero's narrative in general. We have taken something that is so iconically white and male and pushed the scope. How did Tix, Atticus's a character, push the scope?
Wow. I think of the heroes that we have, right? The way they are presented in cinema and even in fiction and nonfiction, you know, these gentlemen. We're talking about the male hero. So there's the male hero and there's the female hero. But we're speaking specifically about the male heroes that I feel as Freeman joins the pantheon of. But with that, you have this idea of like, oh, they're these strong men. They're macho. They're in some cases, womanizers. In some cases, these war heroes. In some cases, these huge intellects. That's from Skywalker to James Bond to, you know, all these fellas, you know. What we have in Atticus is we have a mixture, a soul that is like the cornucopia of all of those things. And then on top of that, he's Black. On top of that, he's young. On top of that, he's about his family's business. That is something I believe I've not read before, nor have I seen it before. And that was the gift that Lovecraft Country, and specifically the role of Atticus, presented, that I tried to embody to the best of my ability.
Well, you know what? Let's keep on. I was going to ask this question later, but given the answer you just gave, I'm going to move this question up. And so the overall question about Black masculinity, I mean, you've said you see in your roles in The Last Black Man in San Francisco, that's the first time I saw you, which I absolutely loved for reasons we'll get into. Lovecraft Country, The Five Bloods, they're part of a trilogy on Black masculinity. What do you want viewers to take away?
You know, it's interesting, right? Because I think of the word, the number three, right? And the thing about the number three is that we think, oh, that number symbolizes perfection, right? There's always the trilogy, etc. And that is how things are presented, right? What I feel I was trying to accomplish in my journey with those particular roles. And those roles all kind of came at a certain time. They all shared the same journal, actually. And what was happening at that moment is like, okay, we have the opportunity here to give the number four, right? Which to me, and in numerology, is a number of completion, right? And so with that, we get a complete picture, a complete mosaic of what it is to be, at least in this iteration, and for that time, in those years in which those films came into the world, a time to show here is Black masculinity, incompletion, right? What does that mean? We have the strength of the culture. We have the vulnerability of the culture. We have the complexity of the culture. We have the intellect of the culture. Now listen, one man cannot do that, right? Not one artist cannot take on that entire feat. However, in my journey, in my walkthrough, what I was getting to explore in that was that idea. And that was my mission and objective in portraying those fellows.
You know, in particular, about The Last Black Man in San Francisco, one of the things that made it a standout for me, aside from your performance and the storyline, it was the fact that for the first time on camera, at least for me, I saw Black male vulnerability, Black men being able, crying on screen, being emotional, embracing each other, comforting each other. And for the first time, I felt like I was seeing seeing me and my life and who I am in 3D, as opposed to two-dimensional or a caricature of who Hollywood says I am that I can't even relate to. When you take these roles, do you find that you either push back against maybe portraying the character in a two-dimensional way, or are these roles written with the complexity of what it means to be specifically a Black male in America, since all of these characters we're talking about are Black men in America?
Where do I start? I'll break it down like this. To me, my job as a actor, my job as an artist, is to always tell the truth. And I think it is a mixture of a few things. I think on the page, literally, and you have to understand, on the page, we used to do this exercise in drama school where Laura Henry, who was one of my beautiful acting teachers, would say to us when we would watch cinema, as you're watching the movie, think about the writing that they're saying, right? To be or not to be, okay? That is literally T-O-B, etc., right? There is nothing there. There is nothing there. That is just the language. That is just, as we would say, the sound of the moment. It is then our job as the actors to go, okay, well, how do we make this sound pertinent, relevant, and truthful? And so for me, I did have the benefit of having great writers and people who allowed me to embrace that language and to push that language forward. But there's so much responsibility on the actor, on the artist to add in behavior, right? I can say in all of those pieces, there is no line that says, and if it was, I'd probably mark it out, character laughs here, character cries here, they embrace. None of that on the page. All of that comes from the written word inspiring behavior, right? And so one of the things that makes things little wild is that I don't watch too much cinema. You know, when they say it's hot, I'll check it out. If it's a contemporary of mine, I like to know what's going on. But I try very much to just look outside and go, okay, what is it that I've experienced? What is it that I see my brothers experiencing? And this, and the cheat sheet for me is, I'm always trying to tell the secret. So So when you watch Last Black Man of San Francisco based off your evaluation just now, I would say that is, irregardless of how one feels about the film, but if you feel, oh man, Montgomery Allen and Jimmy Fails represent or show, right, the secret, right, the secret of a culture, right? That's the beautiful thing about culture. There's all these, there's all these forms of decorum. There's all these ways of thinking, that ways of behaving, ways of interacting with each other, that we do not necessarily, they don't really ask you to do that in the job. It's not mandatory, you know. People make, it's not mandatory, but for me, it's kind of the only way I know how to get after it. Something that really excites me about it.
You know, speaking of, you know, you use the word culture, and I'm just wondering, to sort of bring it back to Lovecraft Country, what role does and should entertainment play in the conversation about race and history? Because, you know, as I said in the intro, and for those who haven't watched Lovecraft Country, I was having trouble saying it.
Lovecraft Country. Yeah, it's now a vocal exercise. Yeah. Oh, good. Yeah.
Well, thank you for that free vocal lesson. But you know, the thing about the Lovecraft Country is that it is set in Jim Crow America, and the scenes from Jim Crow America, I'm going to be very honest with you, Jonathan. I had to stop watching the series because the Jim Crow stuff was so, it was so scary and frightening. And also I was watching it at the tail end of the last administration, so that also played a part of it. But I'm just wondering, you know, what role should entertainment play in the conversation over race and history?
If you don't mind, I'd like to play entertainment and art together. That's cool.
Ah, okay. Sure.
Because I'm going to go to my, I'm going to go to one of the gods to, for my springboard there. August Wilson said multiple times that art should not be political, but art is inherently political, right? It is inherent that it's political. We're dealing with the people, right? The populace, right? The populace, the cultures and the ideas of the populace equals the politics of a state, of a nation, of a city-state, etc., of a restaurant, whatever. So there is no avoiding it. There is no avoiding it. You and I speaking together right now, we have two Black men of two different generations. I'm not sure where you're from, but I'm certain it's not from where I'm from. But we are in a conversation, right? So anybody watching this can take a side and go, young, mature, Southern. I mean, again, I don't know where you're from, right?
But New Jersey.
Yeah, you're Yankee, right? New Jersey, right? Like that type of, that is politics. There's no way around it. There's no way around it. Yeah, there's no way around it. So fulfilling the art form, right? Doing your job, you know, do the damn job, but doing the job, right? Incites that type of, political talk, that type of thinking. There's no way around it. There's no way around it. Now, there are artists who aim, there is political art, and that's a different thing.
You know, Lovecraft Country landed right like smack in the middle of our yet another national conversation on race, but this time more fraught because of the murder of George Floyd. And I'm wondering, did that bring into focus for you the significance of what you were doing in Lovecraft Country?
Absolutely. I remember, I mean, when it all went down, when it was all revealed, and our brother George Floyd became the incident that triggered the flood, all of this, both Lovecraft Country and the Five Bloods, they were right on the brink. I don't remember who was out first or what was going on when, but I was going, we all were. And I saw Lovecraft as a participant in the conflict, in the rebellion, in the protest. I saw it as a piece of art, which is, as we said, inherently political. It was an ally. Art can be an ally, and I found it to be that. And there are multiple times when I thought of George Floyd's story, George Floyd's legacy, who George Floyd was and is, what he's left with us. He's a hero. And it's so interesting, we're looking at George Floyd, who is a large African-American male, and he was being villainized by these police officers and also paid the ultimate price. And then you have an Atticus, right? You're a hero, right? Who literally, we could be from the same place. We could be blood relatives, you know, if you took men out of context. Mm-hmm. You see that happen. It was quite moving for me, as a citizen, to know that I participated in something that was out in the world at that exact time, that people were marching on the streets and going home and watching Lovecraft. I mean, that was just one of the most surreal moments of my life, period.
You know, you said last year, hopefully when we get done with 2020, we'll see clearly as a society. And so now that we are past 1 year after the murder of George Floyd, but also 100 years after the Tulsa race massacre, are we seeing more clearly, and are we doing enough in response, do you think?
I would say as a whole, more of us are seeing, right? All of a sudden, so many of us were looking this way, and they go, oh, wait, there's the problem there. There are more people looking at the issue, looking at taking it by the horns, as it were. I do believe that we have progressed as a culture, as a country. I do know that we have a long way to go, a long way to go. And that's going to be a continuous struggle, a continuous conversation, a continuous debate amongst human beings, specifically in our country, amongst Americans, you know, therefore amongst any marginalized group. That's a long road of hope, you know. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of work to be done there. But I will say we have enlisted, right? We as a country, we as a people, we as a species have enlisted more people to participate in this direction, to move in this direction. I think this new administration, I think the work that is being made, I think the work that is being talked about, that's being cultivated, that's being lifted, I think that is a sign that we are no longer just in vogue as a marginalized culture, that of Black folks. We're not just in vogue, we are being seen and promoted in a certain way. And so there is a slight shift of responsibility, which is good. Which is really good, but I still have more work to do. Hugh Johnson still have more work to do. Our families and friends and the children we raise still have a lot of work to do. Our administration has a lot more work to do. But I think we now know that the work is there to be done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your wider journey. When you were younger, you'd been suspended in one school. You started to skip classes in another. And had been caught shoplifting. One of the people you met in juvenile detention taught theater arts. What did she tell you about acting that excited you?
She didn't tell me anything about acting, but what she did allow me to do, and what she did promote, and what she did make space for me to do, was to express Miss LJ. And just for the narrative, I was back in the school system.
Okay.
It was like first week back in the school system. And she allowed me to express all of that. It's caged. There is a caged mentality that makes you want to revolt, that makes you want to fight, that makes you want to do whatever you can to be seen and to be heard by any means necessary. Damn the consequences, mm-hmm. right? That was just my psychology at the time. And it was so deep that it wasn't, there was no malice, you know? I mean, it's funny, my mother's spirit is with me this entire morning. Like, there was never any malice, and I knew that coming from me, and my mother knew that. And what she did was she allowed me to slowly, it's like the water hose on my expression had been pinched, and she allowed it to come out. And so when it first comes out, it hits hard, you know, it's physics, boom. And then after that, there's a certain amount of flow, a certain amount of, and then to go with the metaphor, that water coming out, that experience coming out is no longer hurtful. It can actually water. It can actually not push the soil out of the way, but lay on top of the soil, you know, and allow something to mm-hmm. grow. And here we are today.
Right. Well, in fact, I believe it was in that interview with Helena where you said, I began to find out things about myself emotionally, like where my tears come from and the fact that I had a great deal of empathy. That began to open up my emotional drain. You said acting showed you how to live. How so?
I said that? yeah, because once you... I believe it's Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, right? That book that talks about prisoners in the Holocaust camps. And once someone has a reason, right, to live, once they know how to do it, right, that was the lifeblood of the spirit. And so for me, acting said, oh. This is how you behave. This is without parenting. This is how I want to behave, right? This is how I want to be. This is how I want to move through the world. And how is that? Now, I don't succeed with this all the time, but it is with empathy. It is with understanding. It is with patience. Why? Because when I am in that place, right, that calm, when I am in that place, I am then in communion with my fellow brothers and sisters, you know, and therefore I can then tell their stories. I can then understand their stories in a way that allows us to move everything forward as a group. And so, yeah, you think twice when you're losing your temper, or you go, oh, I'm losing my temper because of this. And so it became this whole kind of, I mean, for lack of a better term, it's the best therapy one can have, you know, to really lean into what it is to, again, there's different schools of thinking, and at 31 years old now, I'm kind of just now in the place where I say, no, I have my own approach to the work. Mm-hmm. I have my own, I've been a citizen long enough, no longer under the protection of an institution. I'm rearing a child myself, you know, like, I now have a way that I want to move world, and acting gave me it's the manual, it's the blueprint. Mm-hmm. You know, in order to do what I do the way I'd like to do it, this is how I must behave, this is how I must govern myself.
Mm-hmm. You know, June is Pride Month, LGBTQ Pride Month, and from what I understand, during your last semester at Yale, you were cast in the LGBT miniseries When We Rise. Why did that role mean so much to you?
Oh, my brother. It means even more now. I just have to say that. I played a fella named Ken Jones. And Ken Jones is no longer with me. He transitioned about 8 months, probably less than a year now, actually. And that experience, and that role, and the journey of that means so much to me. One, because I was at the Yale School of Drama. I was in my final semester, and I auditioned, and I won the role, and that in and of itself was such a for me, because I had started graduate school with a 3-month-old, with a 3-month-old kid. And here we were now, and she was nearly 4, and I had been practicing my craft, and literally, this is more the meta of it. I don't know what you're asking, but it's all connected, and doing what I had to do to, to behave properly, and support the best I could. And then the role came, and I was surrounded by angels, chiefly Ken Jones. But there was Dustin Lance Black, who wrote it. There was Dustin Van Zandt, who was directing it. Cohen, who was producing it. And I was literally taken from New Haven, Connecticut, Vancouver. And it was a complete whirlwind. And the only thing I had was what I had actually learned and what stuck, right? So I only had who I was, technically, spiritually, etc. And it literally changed my life. I mean, for the first role that one plays to be to be one of the leads in the show, to be telling the story of a man who lived and lived boldly and great. It just opened up the floodgates even more, my brother, for everything to flow.
It sounds as though each character you play, no matter when you've played them, you allow them to occupy space in you, and then after you move on to the next film, the next piece of art, the next play, bits and pieces of those characters stay with you. If not being a part of your acting, at least a part of you, of who you are, of your soul. It's as if you learn from them.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes. I mean, that to me, the fear is always like, if you listen to narratives, someone says, you should only do, one film a year. Oh, you don't want to go that deep. Oh, you want to, there's all this taboo stuff, that I feel handicaps, that can handicap the artist, right? That can do. But it's how you do it. And for me, I go, well, my experience is as such that the role picks you. And if the role chooses you, you have to surrender to that, right? They give you all the bells and whistles to make you comfortable, to make you feel good, to, make you feel pretty and all this shit, all this stuff, Like, they do all that, and that's fine, I kind of push it. It's not primary for me, because what's primary is the internal growth that each character gives, because each character is going through their own struggle. I mean, that is the best type of advice one can get. Right, I'm going to experience the hardship and the wins and the losses of another human being, and to really go through that, to really experience that, I'm gonna learn from that. My nervous system. I mean, one of the things they say in acting, your brain does not know the difference. Your body does not know the difference, of what's going on. So when you go into those places, you always come out good writing. You always come out, That's the beauty of it. Mm-hmm. And then the instrument is changed, right? It's as if you're a piano and you have all these different musicians come to play on it, right? You want that. You want to be played in that way. It helps. So, yeah, it helps. I'll conclude.
All right. So you said you said a key phrase in that in your response. The role picks you. So that leads me to a story that was reported in Deadline on June 2nd. I'm just going to read it to you. Michael B. Jordan is looking to up the ante in his directorial debut for Creed III, and his next opponent appears to be none other than rising superstar Jonathan Majors. That true? Are you going to be in Creed III?
It's so deep. I didn't talk to my publishers. I don't know how they dressed. Yeah, if all goes according to plan, it should work out. Yeah, I don't mind. Yeah, I mean, we'll deal with it. I'll deal with the fallout if something crazy happens from that. But yeah, I was never told not to speak on it.
Well, well, I am glad. I am glad that it appears. It appears as though we have you, not we, you have made some news on this Creed 3 issue. Jonathan Majors, as always, whenever I do these Washington Post Lives, I go overtime, and we are overtime. So I just want to thank you very much for spending time with us here and for coming on Washington Post Live.
Could I say one thing?
Sure, absolutely.
Just real quick. The beauty of the potential of the Creed thing is very much what we're doing now. The support of it, right? That here you are supporting me doing this. Here I am supporting you doing this. And what we will potentially do, right, is something we've not seen before in many ways. I mean, we had our brother Daniel and Lakeith do it, which is a great example of supporting one another in the art and pushing things forward together. Because 1 + 1 = 3. And so if anyone watches this, like, please, please, please just support your fellow artist, support your fellow man. And yeah, that's it.
and that is a great message to end on. Jonathan Majors, acting superstar. It is there, right? Superstar, Jonathan Majors. Thanks so much again for coming to Washington Post Live. And as always, thank you for joining us and hanging in there as we went over. Come back at 3 p.m. Eastern today when my colleague David Ignatius will sit down in conversation with Peter Marr, president of the International Committee of the Red Cross, about the humanitarian crises posed by COVID-19 and armed conflicts around the world. Once again, I'm Jonathan Capehart, opinion writer for The Washington Post. Thank you very much for tuning in to Washington Post Live.
Thanks for listening. To hear more interviews from this series and other Washington Post Live programs, visit us at WashingtonPostLive.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.